Well, good afternoon, brethren. I want to thank the gentleman for the special music. That was truly lovely. I love it when we can clearly hear the words that are being spoken and contemplate and maybe dwell on them. So thank you very much. I think that Dave Delamater's message and mine will fit together about hearing God's voice and listening. I would like to think that God spoke to both of us on that subject. Dave, I'm sorry about those letters that you received. No, I didn't send them. But I think they sent those same letters to me. And it's always nice when I encounter Mr. Helge as a friend. Thank you, Mr. Helge. And I'm supposed to give another special plug to that cake auction, but I think he did such a great job on it. I've got so many relatives involved in that cake auction. Please prepare for it now. It is always one of the highlights of the year for us, and it does go to some very worthy causes. I will point out that the two charities or the two areas where the money is going to UCG South America for the Youth Activity Center and to Thailand were the suggestions of the young adults. So they chose from a large list of places they wanted the money to go. So I think that's a very fine thing that they are doing. As many of you are aware, our Kingdom of God seminars have prompted us to look to a place hundreds and hundreds of years ago, 2 millennia ago to the first century. The seminars basically asks us to look at the time of the proclamation that Jesus Christ's ministry began. I'd like to continue with that, but go even further back. Before the New Testament was written, before the temple of Jesus' day was even built, long before the time in Mark when Christ began his ministry, in fact, I'd like to go back to the 9th century, approximately 860 BC or BCE. And I'd like to read you a story today, a story that many of you have heard. It's an important story in the Old Testament. It's about power and prestige, about arrogance and pursuit, but it also is about poetic justice. And the times that God tries to speak to us and make us aware of him. And sometimes he does this from people we barely acknowledge, that we barely know. We're in Assyria, also known as Aramea at that time in 860. And we enter this story that indeed has much irony. We're near the capital and we're with the army where we read of an interesting commander. The king of Aramea, or Syria at the time, is Ben-Hadad II, though he is not mentioned by name. He had been making raids into the northern kingdom of Israel, whose capital was Samaria. Jehoram was king at that time. So turn with me, if you would, where our story begins in 2 Kings in chapter 5. In verse 1 of chapter 5, it says, "Now Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great and honorable man in the eyes of his master, because by him the Eternal had given him victory to Syria. He was also a mighty man of valor, but he was a leper. And the Syrians had gone out on raids and brought back a captive, a young girl from the land of Israel. She waited on Naaman's wife." Now we learn a lot just in these first two verses. Naaman is a commander. Many think he was the general of all the Syrian armies of Aramea. So literally thousands and thousands and thousands of men at war were under this one man's command. So he's very important. I want you to picture him as we read through this. I want you to, in your mind's eye, I want you to think of this man with his armor and his retinue and his importance and his prestige. Because the Bible paints a picture and it uses this man to teach us some very interesting lessons. He was this great man of valor, of leadership. He was greatly respected, but he was a leper. Leprosy at the time that this was written was badly or poorly understood. It could have been one of many different skin diseases. But in all cases, they were highly contagious. They looked horrible, and there was no real cure for them. They basically contained them. It made Naaman fierce-looking, to be sure. Because it was noticed in this verse of chapter 5. Everybody knew he was a leper. We're given no details. But undoubtedly, like anyone that has the disease even today, they'd like to be healed of it. Leviticus, we won't turn there, but Leviticus chapters 14 and 15 are extensive in the ability to try and contain leprosy. We know that from historical records that the lepers in Jesus' day were supposed to have a bell that they would ring as they approached the city. Leper, leper, they would have to say. So this is a very, very serious disease. But this disease was not on just anyone. This was on the commander of the Syrian army, this great man named Naaman. Interestingly also, God has apparently allowed him to be victorious. But he was no believer in God, as we shall see. In Jewish tradition, Naaman was the man who had killed Israel's king in battle. So if you'll hold your hand in 2 Kings 5 and go back to 1 Kings chapter 22, we'll read a very interesting recounting of this very famous battle. This is 1 Kings chapter 22, and we'll begin in verse 29. So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, went up to Ramoth-Gilead, and the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, I will disguise myself and go into battle, but you put on your robes. So the king of Israel disguised himself and went into battle. Now the king of Syria had commanded the 32 captains of his chariots, saying, fight with no small or great, but only with the king of Israel. So it was when the captains of the chariots saw Jehoshaphat that they said, ah, surely this is the king of Israel. Therefore they turned aside to fight against him, and Jehoshaphat cried out. And it happened, when the captain of the chariots saw that it was not the king of Israel, that they turned back from pursuing him. Verse 34. Now a certain man drew a bow at random and struck the king of Israel between the joints of his armor. So he said to the driver of his chariot, turn around and take me out of the battle, for I am wounded. The battle increased that day, and the king was propped up in his chariot facing the Syrians and died that evening. The blood ran out from the wound into the floor of the chariot and fulfilled a prophecy. Jewish tradition, and they feel their historical record, says indeed that was Naaman. Now turn back with you, if you would, to 2 Kings chapter 5. And so whether or not it is true, it is still interesting nonetheless. These men were in close combat, and we can very readily understand that Naaman, had he been that man, he would have been promoted as a man of valor and awarded because of the death of the king of Israel and the defeat of the Israelite armies. And so when we read this, I want you to think of this man. And they had had raids occasionally into Israel. And sure enough, one of those raids, a Jewish girl, a young girl, fell into the hands of Naaman, this field marshal. He was a servant in his household. She attended Naaman's wife. And so we pick up the story further in verse 5. If I can get back into 2 Kings, I almost read you from 1 Kings. So in verse 3. Then she, the young girl, the young maiden from the land of Israel, she said to her mistress, Naaman's wife, if only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy. And Naaman went in and told his master, the king, saying, thus and thus said this girl who is from the land of Israel. So she tells Naaman's wife, there is a prophet in Israel. This little girl, the small girl that is a servant or a slave in Naaman's household. She talks about this man who is a prophet in Israel. It's important to understand that at the time, Aramea or Syria worshipped Rimmon or Baal. In Assyria, he was called Ramanu. In Israel, obviously, was the God of Abraham, of Yahweh. And they were in contention all this time whose God was more powerful. So this little girl says there is a prophet in Israel. And by implication, he can and he will heal if given the opportunity, because he's a prophet not just of Israel, he's a prophet of the God of Israel. And so Naaman obviously wishes to rid himself of leprosy. Obviously, his wife told him of the story of the little girl. He does not speak to the little girl. He goes directly to King Ben-Hadad. He relays the story of the young girl. So here are the two most powerful men in this country, and all of Aramea, the king and his general, acting upon the word of a little girl, a little servant girl who's been captured. Her name is lost, but to God, but we will see how mightily she has been used by God. We continue the story in verse 5. Then the king of Syria said, "Go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. Then he brought the letter to the king of Israel, which said, "Now be advised, when this letter comes to you, that I have sent Naaman, my servant, to you, that you may heal him of his leprosy." So the king writes a letter. "Heal my commander," he says. No mention of a prophet or of God or even the little girl. In fact, acknowledging the king was listening to women and servant girls in that day was absolutely, positively unthinkable. Can you imagine how the letter would be? "Hey, we captured one of your kids. She's talking about your prophet." He can't start off that way. He's the king. This is his commander. So one king says to the other king, "Heal my commander, my general." And so Naaman, the unbeliever, says in his head, "I know what I'll do. I'll buy the cure. I'll buy the cure." So he loads up with Gucci bags of silver and gold. He brings pairs of Armani and Versace, and off he goes with his retinue of horses and possibly some camels. It's got to be quite a sight. The distance is estimated at 40 to 50 miles. 40 to 50 miles was 1, 2, 3, possibly 4 days of riding. This was the commander. And so he comes across from Syria to Samaria. And you can just picture it. The general and all his stuff, right, loaded down with a letter from his king to the king of Israel. All based on the word of a little girl. In verse 7, we'll see that clothes do figure heavily in this story. The king tears his. In verse 7, and it happened when the king of Israel read the letter that he tore his clothes and said, "Am I God to kill and make alive, that this man sends a man to me to heal him of his leprosy? Therefore, please consider and see how he seeks a quarrel with me." He obviously has Naaman in front of him and all of his retinue, probably in the throne room. And the king of Israel has all of his people around him. This is a big deal. This is an emissary from one enemy king to another king. And he reads the letter. "Be advised, when this letter comes to you, I've sent Naaman, my servant, that you may heal him of his leprosy." The king of Israel flies into a rage. "Who does he think I am? Am I God? I'm supposed to heal him of his leprosy? Do I make people live and die? I think it's obvious he says this to the court or the people around him. He seeks a quarrel." In the literal, it literally says, "What is he thinking, this Aramean king? What is he up to?" There's more to this. So just picture it. He's torn his clothes, which at the time, as we all know, was a sign of outrage, of hearing blaspheme. So he tears his clothes. So verse 8, "So it was when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, he sent to the king saying, 'Why have you torn your clothes? Please let him come to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel.'" And so we see that Elisha hears about this issue going on in the throne room. He knows what Naaman is there for, and word has gotten back to him that he is there really. Elijah's a prophet. Elisha's the prophet of God. He probably knew what was happening here. "And send him to me. He will know." In verse 9, "Then Naaman went with his horses and chariots, and he stood at the door of Elisha's house. And Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, 'Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored to you, and you shall be clean.' But Naaman became furious and went away and said, 'Indeed, I said to myself, he will surely come out to me. Stand and call on the name of the Eternal, his God. Wave his hand over the place and heal the leprosy.'" That would be fanfare. "I'm a commander. Are not the Abana and the Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?" So he turned and went away in a rage. The word there is interesting. It's used frequently in the Old Testament. The word rage means he snapped. He literally broke. He was so angry. I can just imagine Here is the general in full armor, to be sure, surrounded by his men and his horses and his Gucci bags and all his stuff. He knocks on Elisha's door. Servant comes. Go wash in the Jordan 7 times. You'll be clean. Shuts the door. What? What? Doesn't he know who I am? Can't he tell? All my stuff? Doesn't he know? Isn't he going to come out and make some big pronouncement? I'm supposed to go and wash in this Jewish, muddy river, the Jordan? I've got rivers at home that are far better than the Jordan. So he is enraged. He's angry. And then verse 13, an intervention. In verse 13, and his servants, those of Naaman, Naaman's servants came near and spoke to him and said, "My father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, would you not have done it? How much more then, when he says to you, 'Wash 7 times in the Jordan, wash and be clean'?" This was something simple. This is easy to do. They entreat these servants of Elisha. They entreat the mighty and the powerful Naaman. And they say, just do it. It's so simple, isn't it? You'd have done something, if it was something greater, that would have been harder to do. This is easy. So they come to his aid. They talk sense to him. And he listens again. Verse 14. So he went down and dipped 7 times in the Jordan, according to the saying of the man of God. And lo and behold, his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. It means not only that he was clean ceremonially, because the leprosy was gone. It means he was healed. It means it was as he was when he was a boy. He looked down at his skin and he said, "This is a miracle. This is the skin that I had when I was a small boy." What was his reaction? The years of leprosy were removed. How long had he had it? We have no idea. More than likely, it had been for a long, long time. He was an adult. He'd been in the army probably most of his life, as most of the soldiers were. So all the embarrassment, all the pain, all the torment was gone. Now you count to yourself how long it would take you 7 times to immerse yourself in a bath of water. Probably 15, maybe 30 seconds. So in half a minute, years and years of the leprosy were gone, and he was a changed man, top to bottom. Verse 15, Naaman returned to the man of God, Elisha, he and all his aides, and came and stood before him. Now watch carefully the language and the words that are used in 2 Kings chapter 5. They're very, very carefully selected. He came to the man of God, he and all his aides, and came and stood before him. The phrase "stood before him" is idiomatic in Hebrew for standing in the presence of someone greater. When you stand before the king, when you stand before God, when you stand before Jesus, stand before means reverently. So he stands before him. And he said, "Indeed, now I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel. Now, therefore, please take a gift from your servant." He was very, very grateful. "But," he said, "as the Lord lives before whom I stand, I will receive nothing." And this is Elisha. "As the Eternal lives before whom I stand, I will receive nothing." And he urged him to take it, but he refused. So here is Naaman with all his soldiers and all the silver and all the gold trying to repay out of thanks. It was a wonderful gesture, trying to repay Elisha. But Elisha knew it was not him that had healed Naaman. He knew that it was God's providence. He was just the instrument. He really had nothing to do with it. He just gave the instructions. It was God to whom he owed thanks. And so he says, I will receive nothing. And he urged him, but he refused. So in verse 17, so Naaman said, "Then if not, please let your servant be given 2 mule loads of earth, for your servant will no longer offer either burnt offering or sacrifice to other gods, but to the Eternal." Notice the words that are used here by this great commander. Your servant, right? 5 minutes earlier, He was the commander. He was the general. He reported to the king of Aramea. Right? The king of Aramea was the only one that he bowed to. And now here he is in a very humble, very gracious, very thankful way. He's saying to Elisha, this prophet, I am a servant. I will no longer offer to any other god, no more Rimmon, but only to the Eternal. Verse 18, yet in this thing may the Eternal pardon your servant. When my master, the king, goes into the temple of Rimmon to worship there, and he leans on my hand, and I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, when I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may the Eternal pardon your servant in this thing. Naaman is aware there is only one God, and he is in Israel. He is aware he must change in who he worships. He continues, he said, go in peace. Go in peace. This is from Elisha. It's interesting that from this point, we can see very, very easily that he wants so much to worship God, he's willing to take the dirt from where they are in Israel. It's known, it's a very important word. It's Haaretz Israel. It means the land, the literal dirt of Israel. And it's considered very special even today. Even today. There's magazines and newspapers in Israel named for that. And so what Naaman has done, he said, if you won't take a gift, let me please take some dirt so that when I kneel down, I will kneel down on dirt that has come from this place. The God who is in Israel. Israel's dirt. This is how much this man has changed. Now, it's interesting. There is so much here that we could talk about it for many, many studies. He says when he kneels with his own king, he says, please pardon me, for I really am worshiping God with this dirt. And he is now a worshiper of God. It's very interesting that he also must ask for forgiveness when he is before Rimmon. That is an interesting study in itself, isn't it? That is not the time. This is not the time or the purpose, but these verses are so poignant. Prophet Elijah also says something very interesting. He says, go in peace. What's interesting is the commentaries, because they are divided whether Elisha approved of Naaman's practice of when he was in Rimmon, or bowing before Rimmon. What's interesting is the Jewish commentaries, God did not accept it. Elisha's comment means he did not accept it. The non-Jewish, we would say the Protestant and the Catholic commentaries, say that by saying go in peace, that is exactly what he meant, that indeed God did accept and understood that he would be a believer, but somewhat in secret because of the situation he was in. Obviously, only God can judge. What's also interesting about the word Rimmon, Rimmon in your Bibles, most of you will have that word, is thought to be a deliberate Jewish scribal error. It's not an error, it's a direct corruption of the word Rumon, which is the proper name for this god at this time, or Ramon. Rimmon, R-I-M-M-O-N, interestingly enough in Hebrew, means pomegranate. So they think there was a little bit of a dig when 2 Kings 5 was written. We continue. In verse 19, we see where Elisha has said to Naaman, go in peace. So he departed from a short distance. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said to himself, look, my master has spared Naaman the Syrian, while not receiving from him his hands what he brought. But as the Lord lives, I will run after him and take something from him. And so Gehazi pursued Naaman. When Naaman saw him running after him, he got down from the chariot to meet him and said, is all well? Now in that phrase again, when you're the commander of an army of legions, you do not get down from your chariot for anyone, ever. You stand in your chariot and you allow them to talk to you because you have the height advantage. But Naaman's a changed man. He gets down from the chariot and asks, is everything okay? Then begin a series of highly unfortunate events perpetrated by Gehazi, and one just leads him deeper and deeper and deeper into his problem. And he said, all is well. My master has sent me. Line number one. saying, "Indeed, just now two young men of the sons of the prophets have come to me from the mountains of Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver and two changes of garments." Lie number two. So Naaman said, "Please, take two talents." And he urged him and bound him, two talents of silver and two bags and two changes of garments, and handed them to two of his servants, and they carried them on ahead of him. When he came to the citadel, he took them from their hand and stored them away in the house. Then he let the men go, and they departed. Verse 25. Now he went in and stood before his master, and Elisha said to him, "Where did you go, Gehazi?" And he said, "I did not go anywhere." Lie number three. Then he said to him, "Did not my heart go with you when the man turned back from the chariot to meet you?" Can you imagine what went through Gehazi's mind? Can you imagine the ice that went through his blood? How did Elisha know? How in the world did Elisha know? He wasn't there. But Gehazi was there. He said, "Did not my heart go with you when the man turned back from his chariot to meet you?" Is it time to receive money and to receive clothing, olive groves, vineyards, sheep, oxen, male and female servants? Is this the time? I wonder, and the commentaries wonder, if this wasn't the first time that Gehazi had done this. We know that he took changes of clothes, and we know that he took money, but the olive groves, the vineyards, the sheep and the oxen, the male and female servants, could very easily have been other times that Gehazi had done this thing. And Elisha knew it. And Gehazi was ashamed. Verse 27, "Therefore the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and your descendants forever." And he went out from his presence, leprous, as white as snow. It's a very, very sad, sad ending. So now it is the leper, Gehazi. If you read on in the book of 2 Kings, you'll know that Gehazi, strangely or fortunately, Gehazi continued to be Elisha's servant. So obviously and hopefully he changed as well. And you can read about that at your leisure. We end the story with this poetic justice, but I want to read from a quote by Chuck Swindoll, which I think you'll find interesting, about this irony. "It is ironic that Naaman, the Syrian, came away from Elisha cleansed, while Gehazi, the Jew who lived as a servant in Elisha's own house, came away accursed. It is ironic, too, that Naaman, the leper, became the servant, and Gehazi, the servant, became a leper. In a downpour of poetic justice, Naaman's loose change became Gehazi's leprous curse. The truth about Gehazi leaked through his roof of thatched lies to expose his greed and drench it in God's sudden and torrential judgment. One of the most hated diseases of that day was now upon Gehazi for the rest of his life and for his descendants." It's interesting. When we read this story, what we glean from it. We hearken back to the first message that we heard today. There are people in our lives, just as in Naaman's life, because it is important to focus on Naaman. The Gehazi tragedy just adds incredible color and depth to this story, which I believe occurred. It's very believable. But we see these people in our lives many times as Naaman did. They are inconspicuous. They are unimportant. They may be too young. They may be too old to listen to. They may be too conservative. They may be too liberal. We decide in our own minds who we decide to listen to, who we will hearken. But they might even be strangers, those that give us words of wisdom, who give us an example. They may be strangers to us, because we really sometimes don't see them. They're the people around us and the things around us, sometimes not even people, but events around us that God has placed there. God has placed there, unbeknownst to us, like posts along the way to help us to understand. They can come in any form. God has placed them there. We know of the verse in the New Testament that tells us that many times we entertain angels unawares. They may be strangers. And all of us have either heard or been a part of, we have, in our family, where we think we might have encountered an angel. And so we see these things as God's asking us to be aware. He asks us to be God-aware, aware of the little things as well as the great things in our lives that God tries to teach us. Just as in Naaman's case, God used a little girl. Not only was she a little girl, she was a slave girl. She was from the hated Israelites. So of all people for him not to listen to, it would be her. Not only did she listen to them, his wife listened to them. And had his wife not listened, Naaman would never have known. And so Naaman's case, the little girl was used, Elisha's servant was used, and his own servants. People that are less than the commander of Aramea, less than the king of Israel, less than the king of Syria. But yet they were used to guide and direct. In fact, in verse 2 of the story, we're told that God has been providentially controlling Naaman's life in the victories that he won. I imagine that Naaman understood that later. We know no more of Naaman after this book, not really, not to the degree that we read here. But one of the questions of this chapter we can ask ourselves, how much of Naaman and how much of Gehazi are we? If you were to list those characteristics of these two men side by side, how many of them would line up with us? Naaman's leprosy was a physical issue. It was obvious. It was visible. You could see it. Everyone knew it. Obvious and visible. Gehazi's greed was buried and hidden. All of us often have leprosy type issues and Gehazi's greed issues. In fact, what's interesting is that Naaman and Gehazi traded places. Naaman listened to those who gave him wise counsel. He was aware of God and reaped the benefits and the blessings of believing in God. Gehazi acted on greed and deceit. Greed and deceit. And many times we can be a little like Gehazi and we be a little like Naaman. We are left to deeply ponder what God is trying to tell us. But we have to, again, as we heard in the first message, we have to listen. We have to hear. Some of us, especially men, we are not known for our ability to listen. I'm reminded quite frequently of my inability to listen. I hear fine. I just don't listen very well. I think God wants us to be listeners. He wants us to be hearers. He wants us to be aware. And God's people are so precious to him, so important to him, that I believe he does give us sometimes servants. I have no servants, but they act as a servant or a little girl. There are things we can learn from anyone, of any age, from every perspective, as long as God is working with them to work with us. 2 Kings gives us an excellent comparison and contrast of what to do and what not to do. Indeed, it shows if we combine the two men together, it's a picture of humanity, isn't it? The pride and the arrogance in Naaman and the greed and the deceit in Gehazi. Greed and deceit and arrogance and pride stop our ears. They stop us from listening. It stops us from hearing. And only when those things are removed, we can hear. In fact, we can see what God may be giving to us. It tells us more that if we will listen to God, we will hear who speaks to us. We will know, and we should know, as it tells us throughout the Bible, that we do know and can hear the shepherd and the master's voice. As he follows us, we need to listen. We need to be aware. that God will give us counsel in many forms and in very different ways, and we must be able and willing to hear them. God speaks to his people constantly. We do it through music. We do it through conversation. We do it through fellowship, through meals, in a myriad of ways. But he also shows us things outside of the church. He warns us. He teaches us. He's trying to get us to listen. He's trying to help us understand that he is very much involved in us as family because we are all his children. God can use anyone at any time to speak to us about anything if we will only listen. In fact, as with Naaman, we can listen even from a little girl.